I come from a techie tradition, but I'm really trying to help publishing and help people share information. So the general idea of what I'm doing is to try to make people be able to offer and learn from other people, but using the tools of my trade, which is technology. The internet has got lots and lots of good, the bad, and the ugly is all out there on the internet. And what we, the key trick to using the internet or making it useful for people is to make them easy for people to express what they liked and didn't like and how to learn from other people.
Information technology pioneer Brewster Kahle, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine. Brewster Kahle is a founder of Internet Archive in San Francisco, California. He's here to talk about publishing and preserving information in cyberspace. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, created in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. Ongoing support for Soundings comes from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products.
When searching doesn't work anymore and you can just find the pages based on giving a couple keywords, which is the current navigation structure on the World Wide Web, that's starting to not work. You're getting 4,000, 10,000 answers from things you just don't want to know about. And the internet is growing at such a rate that that's going to become even more of a problem. So how do you find information you're looking for? And it's based on your friends, colleagues, going and recommending things. Have you read any good books lately? Is probably the best navigation structure we've got. I'll go see any movie that a couple of my friends recommend that I go see. I don't care what it's about. As long as a few of my friends thought it was relevant, then I'll go see it. That type of mechanism is required on the World Wide Web to make sense of it. And with a library structure or a deep knowledge base of what the content is on the net and where people have gone, we can build that.
In the late 1980s, Brewster Kahle invented WAIS, the Wide Area Information Server System. Kahle's invention helped bring commercial and government agencies onto the Internet by selling Internet publishing tools and production services to companies including Encyclopedia Britannica, the New York Times, and the Government Printing Office. Prior to his work with WAIS, Brewster Kahle designed supercomputers at Thinking Machines Corporation. In April of 1996, in an effort to build a large-scale information repository and to understand the nature of technological innovation, he helped establish Internet Archive, a kind of Internet backup and global library for information technology.
What we're doing is we're taking snapshots of what's going on out there, of the public information on the World Wide Web, and storing it on computers in such a way that it can then be processed and combined with how people have used it to help personalize it. So to help, the question is, how do you make it so that any person can find the information they want? And that information actually may have already been deleted from the original server. Or the reason why you'll find it is your friends liked that particular movie or they liked that particular article. And that's the key way you're going to find the things that you want. We're trying to put in place mechanisms to help people move through information based on enduring content and a context of how people have used it. That's what the Internet Archive is.
You've opened an immense number of doors here that we could pursue, Brewster Kahle. Again, the Internet Archive, before our conversation here in the recording studio, you said that you used the analogy of the bookstore and the library. How do you fit into that configuration?
If the World Wide Web is the current newsstand, a huge newsstand or bookstore, what happens after the day has passed and you can't get to that day's newspaper. If you want to refer to it, where is it? Well, there's a library infrastructure in the print world. In the electronic world, it's gone. It's completely gone. You can't find what was on Yahoo on the internet a year ago. There's no record of it. So what we're doing is we're making a record over time so that you can cite other documents. So it's safe for scholarly publishing.
How much information is out there, Brewster Kahl? Here we are in the winter of 96, 97, and just give our listeners a general sense of what's there on the Internet.
In the World Wide Web, which is just one of the systems, say different from electronic mail or the bulletin boards, it's got 50 million to 100 million pages.
The kind of thing that here I rattle in front of the microphone, a page, an actual physical piece of paper.
Yes, with some graphics and some text on it. The average page size is 6 kilobytes, but it also has some graphics on it and pointers to other pages, and that's what the World Wide Web is made of. And it's about 2 terabytes.
And now let's pause on this very quickly. We move from kilobytes to megabytes to what's the next step up?
Gigabytes. And then to terabytes. Uh-huh. So a terabyte is 1 million megabytes, or what you can put on a floppy is a megabyte. So the Internet is about 2 million floppies. Uh-huh.
Now, we're in a room, just to give our listeners a concrete sense of this, Brewster Kahl, we're in a room that maybe 15 feet by 20 feet. What would be the size of the machine necessary to store? This just blew me away when you told me you could put everything, all the information that's on the web in a machine. How big?
It's about the size of 2 file cabinets.
So much, much smaller than the room that we're sitting in.
Oh, yes. Digital libraries will be much more dense in information than our current paper equivalents. So in the size of a 2-drawer file cabinet, you can store about 2 terabytes, which is about 1/10 the size of the Library of Congress.
Does that mean that what happens in these digital archives will not only enrich our lives in the sense that we can retrieve and use information, is it really going to change our lives? I mean, is there a sort of a political or an ideological element at work here in what not only what we're doing to information technology, but what it might do to us in return?
If we're successful, yes. Mm-hmm. If we're not, then it just becomes another television. Mm-hmm. It's just another mechanism for a few players to get their information out to masses.
Right.
But if we're successful in the Internet in building a distributed medium that allows millions of people to communicate with each other in a new and different way by sharing what they've learned, without having to go through intermediaries of big publishing houses, then we'll have been successful in creating something that's never been done before.
But don't these big publishing houses have a vested interest in making sure that what you're talking about doesn't happen?
I don't think so. The big publishing houses have a real role for distilling what's useful to large numbers of people and then distributing it well. The Internet has the capability as well of finding micro-communities, moving beyond a global village to a globe of villages again, where you may be really close friends with people that you've never physically met. And these communities share content, they share context, they give gifts to each other, they help each other out. And we've seen that over the last several years. An unprecedented number of people are thinking, yes, I can publish. Finally, I've got a mechanism to get my poetry out, my recipes, pictures of my kids. I have a mechanism of doing this. Now the problem is making sense of it all.
Right.
We've succeeded to an unprecedented and horrible degree where the Internet is just filled with all sorts of inappropriate material.
Well, treasure and trash.
We
run the gamut. Now, Brewster, one of the things that you are noteworthy for among your many achievements is a strong interest and a participation in assembling the presidential websites. I'm leading you to this because I want to hear you talk very concretely and illustrate for our listeners the way all of this information gets used. Now, apart from what, nostalgia or scholarly historical usage, why would anybody be interested in what the presidential election 1996 websites looked like? Why are they important to you in your work at the Internet Archive?
The presidential election websites were important to the Smithsonian because if this Internet does become a new medium, then these are the equivalent of the new bumper stickers or the early campaign ads on television, which weren't saved. So we thought this time round, we're going to save to be able to understand how are people using the medium to illustrate their their electoral points of view, their press releases, and the like. So often with these presidential election websites, once they pull out of the race, within hours, often they were turned black, and you can't get at them again.
So you were taking these, to come back to a figure that, that runs through a lot of the material that I looked at in preparing for our conversation, you're coming back to this sort of snapshot mentality to figure out what was back there, what the world in its political manifestation or cultural or whatever looked like on a given day under given circumstances. Yes. On the right track?
Yes. By putting a crawler or a spider out there on the web that goes around and collects all the pages on a particular day, we get a snapshot of what a website or a set of websites looked like. So right on election day, we were careful to go out and snarf down hundreds of websites to try to get an idea of how did people use this new technology to learn what their elected officials are saying, where their voting records were. It's a much deeper set of information than the brochures that you get in the mail about the candidates.
Now, Brewster, who's supposed to make sense of this incredible welter of information? On the one side, you might say it would be people like you, Brewster Kahle at the Internet Archive. It might be somebody whose role in life is analogous to the reference librarian. But I hear you saying that the people, the users themselves, in the strictest sort of utilitarian sense, they're the ones who are going to determine over time how all of this information gets used. Now, on the one hand, gosh, that sounds noble and democratic with a little D and terrific. On the other hand, it sounds like chaos. How about this?
There are going to be people all up and down the information distilling process, publishers trying to pull what the good stuff is and put it out to millions. But a lot of information is very personal. It's comes from small groups and goes to small groups. It's never going to make it into the New York Times. They have to do with your PTA or your soccer clubs or your Bible reading groups, whatever it is. Those are the groups that actually are often much more relevant to people. And to have an internet infrastructure that spans down to small groups is the new and different aspect. So yes, actually, I think it's the people that will make sense of this. And by technologists such as myself and others in this field, we're just trying to supply tools so that people can make their way through, leave the trails that they want to leave, don't leave the trails that are maybe embarrassing or things that they don't want to give up in terms of privacy, but allow people to add value to the net within privacy and copyright constraints to help other people.
Now, again, Brewster, you're not an attorney, and we determined that before our conversation, but the work that you're doing at the Internet Archive certainly has a lot of legal and social implications. We've been talking about the social implications. Give us a quick sense of how you come to free speech, the gamut of information, all the way from the front page of our leading newspapers, you know, to these very dark, sinister aspects of what's on the Internet, pornography, that kind of thing. Is that a concern for you in what you do?
Oh, absolutely. The legal aspects are it's a minefield. We get many lawyers that we talk to are very excited about us because they see that the fees that they could go in this new area. Well, who has rights to be able to redistribute this? Who has the rights to take things down?
Now, are you the guy that makes this call?
No. What we're trying to be, in some sense, is a lightning rod or help the discussion move forward.
Just get the controversy and the issues in front of the public.
Yes, but move forward. That we think that if we wait for all of these issues to be settled before we start doing any sort of systematic collection of what is on the internet, it will all be gone, not able to be reconstructed. So the areas of copyright, privacy, import-export, something that may be legal in Thailand, but if we brought it into the United States and put it on a server here, it may be illegal here. Copyright issues usually is about protecting the business model of the original publisher. And we have no intention to try to diminish the business of original publishers. In fact, an archive can help, such that if the publisher, for some particular user, is inaccessible, so the user would find 404, document not found, can't get to the server. For whatever reason, the information superhighway is clogged or whatever it is, then they can go to the archive and get a copy of it. We think it'll make the publisher actually more valuable.
Do you think of yourself as a techie guy, as a historian, as an archivist, as a librarian, an entrepreneur? How do you change these hats around as you move through a typical day?
I think of myself as a technologist that's trying to achieve publishing aims. We're trying to build a new medium, and it requires thinking through the social, the legal, the historic aspects of what it is we're doing. If we don't take those into consideration, we'll make some drastic mistake and we'll end up with something we're really not proud of.
Brewster, do you have any heroes, technological, historical heroes, people that you look back and you think, well, if I could do something, you know, sort of similar to what that man or woman did, how about this?
Ben Franklin, for me, is my history, my historical...
I commend you for being ambitious. That's terrific. And in what way do you look back at Franklin?
He had a mechanism of constructing successful businesses and then spinning them off. He's helped many people by buying their first printing press and getting them up and running.
Right.
Came up with new ideas for different types of organizations and getting other people to think that they're good ideas and run with them. Hmm. And that way his ideas went far and wide rather than being an all-controlling sort.
Well, it's a little bit sobering to think that, 100 years from now, somebody's going to look back on this conversation, and here I am sitting across from the Ben Franklin of the 1990s. Let's hope that happens. Seriously, Brewster, what is your responsibility? If you have no less a figure than Ben Franklin to look back on as a model, and here you look at this wonderful new technology and world that you are moving into as a processor of information, What do you think about things like this? Your responsibility to the culture and the society?
I think we all do. We all think of what is our place, and for me, it's just doing the piece that I know how to do, and then bring in the people that are experts. And how should it be dealt with legally, socially? How should the government be involved?
Can you give us a concrete sense, Brewster, of your life at the Internet Archive or at your previous WAIS in Boston and Thinking Machines? I mean, a real nitty-gritty, you know, that came before you and you said, wow, here's a crossroads that I'm coming to.
We think it's very important to bring in, what is the role of the Library of Congress as time goes on?
Sure.
And at some point, they're going to be able to pick up terabytes of information and become the model digital library, but they're not ready for it. So working with the Smithsonian or the Library of Congress or the National Archives in a responsible way,
right,
such that we can take some risks that they can't, we can do some experiments that they don't have to necessarily own up to, but if they're successful, all of the roads are put in place to be able to work with them. So I've met with Winston Tabb of the Library of Congress to basically pave a converging path such that if we're successful, they get to benefit from it because that's the right place for some of the long-term care and feeding of the human culture that's being expressed in our digital technology.
Brewster, let me get real personal with you for a moment. You have a little boy who's 2 years old at the time we're recording this conversation. What do you want this kid to say to his college classmates maybe 20 years down the road? My dad did this. My dad played such and such a role. Do you want him to remember you in this, I think pioneering is an appropriate term to use, this work that you do?
If my son were to say that my father helped make the internet useful, that it suddenly became not just a scientist's or an academic's communication medium, but a mass medium that helped people express themselves, then I will have been successful.
Brewster, do you see, as you look into the digital and cyber future here, is there a downside? Is there a dark or a sinister side to any of this information technology and what you do at the Internet Archive? It all sounds so rosy and so promising, but I guess I'm compelled to ask you if you see anything bad there on the horizon.
The horrible future, there are a few horrible futures. One is if we recede into a proprietary protocol stage. If for the internet is a commons, it's got open protocols for sharing information. And if we don't make that useful enough, then people will move to something else that is useful.
Now, are you talking about centralizing the control of the internet? Is that's what you're warning us against?
Yes. If the internet, the World Wide Web, or whatever it becomes, is not terribly useful, and some company comes along and says, we can provide you information that all makes sense and it all has a context and it all happens to be ours, that is a world that we don't need to see.
Now, how do you differentiate what you do at Internet Archives from that very scenario? How do you protect yourself from becoming proprietary or controlling when you act as a filter, a processor of information?
We're just adding a piece, a technology step and some storage steps to the existing system that's out there. We're not trying to invent a new one. We're not trying to make proprietary what's out there in the public. We're just trying to be a little bit of added value, have a place towards adding a piece of infrastructure solidness to the internet that already exists and is growing.
Brewster Kahle, again, you run an outfit called Internet Archives. You come out of a background in technology in Boston and now here in San Francisco. One of the things that you gave me to look at as a piece to prepare for our conversation is a piece that is coming out in Scientific American. And you say that you want what you do at the Internet Archive to enable people to answer the hard questions, not what's on at the movies or when will my PTA meet or what about my kids' soccer league, but very large questions. Should I go back to school? How should I raise my children? Man, you're into philosophy and theology here. Talk to us about that.
The hard questions you usually draw on friends, families, psychiatrists, priests are the people that you use to help you guide in those hard questions. And these technologies aren't going to replace those. But we might have an opportunity to find people that are in similar situations than you're in and see what happened to them, or maybe call them up or write them email and find out how did they, if they had that particular disease, how did they fare? Uh-huh. What was the approaches that they took? And by helping people find other people that have gone through the same things that you have, then maybe that can provide some new insights that weren't possible by just knowing a small circle of friends in your town.
So the technology is obviously very important, but after a fashion, it finally becomes irrelevant. It becomes a beside-the-point kind of issue. When you talk about, you could be talking, seriously now, I'm not being sarcastic, you could be talking about the world's largest support group as people try to navigate their lives.
Yes, and the technology, if we're successful, becomes plumbing, and you only notice it when it backs up. It's dull. The point of technologists is to get out of the way right. So people can do what it is they want to do. And we just want to make it so that you have a larger sphere of appropriate people to talk to, appropriate things to read, and if those aspects can help us answer the harder questions of life.
Brewster, a quick footnote to our conversation. Who pays for what you do? How do you support the Internet Archive? Give us a quick sense of that.
Well, there are two parts of the Internet Archive. There's the nonprofit side and the for-profit side. The nonprofit side has an endowment from me based on the sale of my last company to preserve the information over the decades and to refresh the medium and copy it onto new tapes or new crystals or bounce it off the moon or however you store information in the future. Right. The for-profit side is being funded by a set of investors that see the possibility of building successful services as a very profitable business. And in the early 1997, we'll see new services come out.
Here we're back to Benjamin Franklin after a fashion, aren't we? Brewster, I want to tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. You are Brewster Kahle. You come out of a technology background in Boston. You worked for an outfit called Thinking Machines, and now you run a company called the Internet Archive here in the Bay Area. This is available to our listeners at www.archive.org. Have I got this right? Brewster, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you in this series that we've been doing on Soundings on the history and the social implications of information technology. You're an honest-to-gosh pioneer, aren't you? Do you think of yourself that way?
An entrepreneur and publisher.
Fair enough. Brewster, thank you so much for this conversation. I certainly wish you well in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Brewster Kahle of Internet Archive. Special thanks for assistance in the production of this program to Faith Nee and radio station KQED-FM in San Francisco, California. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, created in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefits society. I'll be back in just a moment to tell you where to write for an audio cassette of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Email us at sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ga.unc.edu. This week, it's program number 855. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at www.nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Ongoing support for Soundings comes from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. Next week on Soundings, Southern Storytellers. Join me for readings and conversation featuring two leading writers of literary fiction, George Garrett and John Ely. George Garrett will be here to talk about his new novel, The King of Babylon Shall Not Come Against You. John Ely will also be on hand to discuss his new book, The Journey of August King. Finally, a program note. A few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands and Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided 1-888-650-TOUR. That's 1-888-650-8687. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.